All right, time for another edition of Holding Court, everyone. And I've been looking forward to this for a long, long time now. I got to come clean with everyone. Jose Higueras, my guest today, is a longtime friend of mine, a colleague at the USTA for many years. And I'll just start with this, Jose, because I want to ask you about your background. I know it, but of course, many people may not, how you got into tennis, your great career as a player, and of course, as a coach, and then working with me at the USTA. But when I decided to hire you, when I was running USTA player development as our head of coaching, I said to myself, not only is this guy a great coach, which you are and still are, but you're a better person. And after our years together at the USTA, now I've been long gone there for a number of years, I still agree with my assessment at that time. So it's great to have you on, and I appreciate you giving me some time here on Holding Court. How are you?
Good. How are you, Patrick? Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you for your kind words.
Well, they're still true, but I want people that, you know, many people, of course, in the tennis world know you extremely well for your coaching career. You've coached many of the greatest players ever. You've spent a little time with Sampras, with Federer, a long time with Michael Chang and Jim Courier, and of course with a lot of the young players we see now in American tennis through your position with the USTA. But I find your story about how you got started in tennis as a young kid in Spain really, really cool. So could you tell our audience a little bit about how you got your start as a tennis player?
Yes. Not your typical star. I was born in the country into a very, very poor, family. So I started working as a ball boy at the Real Club in Barcelona when I was 9 years old. And in those days, ball boying was a little different. We were working for money, and I was my first wage was 25 cents an hour. Hmm. So that's how Manolo Santana started. That's how Manuel Orantes started. Andrés Jiménez. In those days, the best players in Spain were ex ball boys. So there's always somebody in your life that lends you a hand. And I had a great model at the club, a teacher, best teacher I've seen with young kids, which is what I got some of my a lot of my ideas teaching. And he helped me like he did a bunch of other kids, and from there we went, you know, and I ended up having a nice tennis career. I wasn't the most talented player, but I was a pretty hardworking person, and it was never enough time to keep practicing. So ended up having a pretty nice career, and I love tennis. I mean, that's what I've done all my life, and from my playing career, I started transition to coaching. I've been lucky enough to come across some great athletes and great players and good people, and until today. So tennis has been good to me. I love the game, and I'm always willing to help in any way I can.
Well, you've been unbelievably good to tennis, and you still are. And by the way, pretty good getting to six in the world is what you did. Your highest ranking on the men's tour is pretty darn good in my book. And a couple of deep runs at the French Open. Of course, clay was your best surface. But what I'm very interested about in this story is, you know, obviously you mentioned Santana, who just passed away, one of the all-time greats from Spain, Orantes, yes, who won the U.S. Open when it was on green clay and was a great, you know, had a great feel for the ball. So mostly these guys were players that were kind of from the other side of the tracks. Like you said, you're poor families, and of course it's changed over the years, but and you're talking about the Real Club in Barcelona, which is still where they play that big tournament, right?
Yes. Yes. Correct. Correct. Yeah. In those days, I mean, for us, this gentleman in Barcelona, as I said, his name was Juan Ventura, and what he did besides helping the ball was he used the ball boys. We could work until we were 14 years old, and then after 14, you had to leave, and then through my going, started to play. I realized how lucky I was because a lot of my peers, some of my ball boy friends, some of them went to jail. Some of them were working construction.
Some of them went to jail?
Yes, because once again, the background the background, you know, we were in the street basically.
Okay.
And this gentleman will help you. And then during the weekends where he had his school, the tennis school for the club, Saturday and Sunday, he will invite you to come. And then from there, he will actually find you jobs. His reputation was so great that he will find you jobs at clubs. So he helped so many kids like me. He helped me trying to, you know, becoming a player, but he helped so many other children becoming really good teachers at clubs in Spain. So basically, that was our escape of making something, you know, with our lives in terms of being able to help our families and all that.
I mind you,
Patrick, that when I was born I was born in the country in the south of Spain in a house with no water nor electricity, and basically, I mean, I had my first, you know, my first TV, black and white, when I was 16 years old, and couldn't run it every day because it was too expensive, the electricity. So some things that start to relate in today's world because we're so lucky to have so much. But anyway, I wouldn't change it for anything. But that's interesting story.
One of the things that I've always admired about you, Jose, as a coach, and I want to ask you about this coach that you had when you were a kid, is in all the years I watched you and I learned from you as a coach, I never once heard you raise your voice to any player. And did that come from your experience as a kid and this coach that you had? You said you learned a lot of things about working with young kids from this particular coach. Is that something you learned, or is that just part of your personality?
Well, a little bit of both. You know, in those days, in the early 60s in Spain, we were living under a dictator, Franco. So I kind of felt the power of power in my head. Mm. And that is something that always stood with me. So through my life, I've always tried to not to remember, because I do remember, but it's something that is not a very good feeling, feeling the power of other people on you, and I think that those experiences kind of helped me. And you know me, Patrick. I mean, I think I'm a tough coach. In a good way, I'm a tough coach because I want the players to do better. But I think I'm a very fair coach, and I will never. I mean, I can tell you at this point, I'm 69 years old. I have never yelled at anybody on the court. I have never insulted anybody on the court, and I never will, because that is a power play that I do not. That I felt it myself in my youth, and I didn't like.
I'm gonna remember that line, Jose. That's the first time I've ever heard you say that. I felt the power of power in my head. That's intense, and that explains a lot. All right, so let me ask you just a couple of what I think are fun questions. Better, you know, compare to me the games, the personalities, and I'm gonna start with these two because obviously they're, you know, two of the greatest ever: Pete Sampras, Roger Federer.
Wow, I mean Roger. You know, Roger, it's tough to compare Roger to anybody because he's so unique on everything how he goes about his game off the court. I would say they're both winners. That's pretty obvious. Pete was a lot more reserved, even though he can crack a joke here and there, but he was a lot more reserved. Where Roger, there's always something funny happening with him. You know, if he loses, you know, I remember when he got killed by Rafa at the French Open, he got four games, and we had a get together with a bunch of friends of him from Switzerland and other places with 40 people. Like to me, I was so depressed and I was so upset.
he had a celebration after getting his ass kicked in the final, right?
My point is that he was so unique, you know, with. Where Pete was a lot more reserved, and that was the biggest difference. You know, they're obviously both great, you know, great champions, but totally different personalities.
And I remember this because we used to talk about it on TV at ESPN that and you didn't work for those guys for that long with those guys for that long. But I remember when you worked with Roger, you were trying to get him to use the drop shot right on clay because he hadn't won the French at that point. He was trying to win the French, and of course, Mr. Nadal was there, so that made things a lot more complicated. And why was he so hesitant? Because he ended up using it a lot when he actually finally won the French Open. But you were sort of the first person that said, "Hey, Roger, maybe you should start using the drop shot on the forehand side." How did that go?
Well, you know, when I first met Roger, I flew to Estoril, and I lost my bag, so I didn't have any clothes. Anyway, I got there, and I got there in the afternoon, so we started watching tapes, and we end up watching video, matches, his matches on clay, on hard courts, on grass, and everything, until 1 or 2 in the morning. Mm. I mean, he loved tennis. And so there, that's when I realized, I said, Jesus, you know, he never hit a forehand drop shot. So I asked him, I said, "Hey, Roger, why don't you use your drop shot on the forehand side?" He said, "Well, why would I do that? I have a huge forehand."
Right.
So then we got into a conversation of the advantages of use of having that shot, which is a very, very offensive shot. Mm-hmm. When people think just because you don't hit the ball 1,000 miles an hour, that is not offensive. It's extremely offensive. So I said, "Well, just imagine that you're playing somebody that is a good retriever, is 10, 15 feet behind the baseline. You have two shots when you have a shot to hit. You know, you go down the line or you go off the court cross court. Those are your two best chances. If you have a third option, that's more than likely is going to change, is going to make the other player change his position and be a little more reluctant to take. But anyway, so the conversation went well, and then the next day we went, and since he's pretty talented, you know that, don't you?
Yeah, he's not bad with the racket, right? Right.
it didn't take him too long to actually start hitting some forehand drops, and then from there on. So that's the story about that.
That's amazing. And Pete Sampras would have been different, right? I mean, was he a little more rigid in the way he went about? I mean, I think of them a little differently. I mean, obviously they're both, as you said, all-time greats. I think of Federer as a guy who just loves tennis, you know, loves to play tennis. And and Sampras to me loved to win. That was a difference. Yeah. I mean, he didn't love tennis in the same way. He used tennis, of course. He loved to compete. He loved to be in that fun, you know, the big match. Would you say that's accurate? That Pete was a little more like he was just out there, like, "I'm here to win, not to necessarily just hit the ball."
I would agree with that 100%. Like I said, Roger likes to feel the ball in his strings. He likes to experiment. If you tell him, obviously, he's not going to experiment with something if he thinks you're full of it.
Right,
but if you tell him something, he will digest it. He will think about it, and those guys are always so thirsty to learn. The only thing, obviously, when you work with a guy like that, you don't have that much to tell them. They know quite a bit already, so you gotta be careful, you know, on the information that you give. But if you get the information and they actually think it's good, that they will because they want to win, and they're great competitors, and they want to get better. Well, but I think your assessment is exact. That's why you have a podcast and I don't.
Listen, you know, I just keep on plugging away here. All right, let me ask you this, because I do want to talk a little bit about the USTA and our time there together and all the blood, sweat, and tears that we put into it, but you a lot more than me over the years. Jim Courier was the guy you spent the most time with. Of course, you worked with Michael Chang when he won the French Open when he was just a teenager. I'm guessing working with those two guys, obviously a little bit different because they were more grinders, more baseline players. What was different about working with each of them? And I know you spent much more time over the years with Jim Courier.
Yes. Well, as I got older, actually one of the best things that ever happened to me for my tennis, not only for my playing tennis career, but also for my coaching career, was the fact that I learned how to play on clay. And then when I got married to Donna, my beautiful wife, and I moved to Palm Springs, I got exposed to a whole different way of playing tennis, which was on hard courts. And in those days, it was a lot faster. So that kind of really expanded my understanding of what the surfaces can do for you and how important it is to understand the game that way, to make yourself richer when you play tennis and when you actually go to compete. So I know, as you said, normally, and that's my background, but I'm actually seeing I'm a decently offensive mind. Mm-hmm. Now, I still believe that the game is a game of errors. And if you have more errors than you have more winners, opposing shots, you are going to lose the match. So the secret is to actually be as complete as you can, as complete a player as you can, which I try to do with Jim and with every player that I work with. I mean, with Roger is an example. What are you going to tell Roger? He's pretty good.
Right.
So, but always looking for ways to better them. With Jim, for example, I think I helped him more than anything with how he understood the game and how to use what he had better. But for example, when we started, you know, his backhand slice was pretty much non-existent. But he didn't have the best backhand slice in the world, but he ended up with a backhand slice that he could actually play. With his volleys, the same thing. So it's always, for me, it's always about getting better. If I get up in the morning and I'm working with somebody, that's in my mind all the time. How can I get this player better? And obviously, depending on the level, you know, the better, you know, change. But that's basically. But with Michael Michael didn't spend that much. I spent with him. He won the French Open, and you probably know that. Patrick, I told you, but you know that I never signed a contract with anybody that I work with.
Right. I know that. Yeah.
I always felt that the day that I don't want to be with him or him or her don't want to be with me, there is no reason why to keep going. So anyway, things happen, but in general, for me, it's about getting better, and according to everybody's abilities. Obviously, you cannot have a like, for example, with Jim. You know, we went to Wimbledon the first time, and he used to serve and volley first and second serve, and he didn't have good enough hands. He had a really good serve. So I said, no, listen, you, why don't we do this? You got a serve and volley. You know, couple of points a game, understand the score, and then you're gonna try to be very offensive on the first ball when you stay back. And actually, he bought into it, and he got to the finals of Wimbledon, which I thought it was a great fit for him.
Yeah, and he lost to Sampras in the final. That was actually in a lot of ways sort of the start of the changing tactics of how to play on grass, right? That these, you know, baseline players were able to play really well on grass. All right, I got to ask you about a couple of other baseline players. One you know very well, and so does everybody in tennis. That's Mr. Rafael Nadal, who just miraculously, in my opinion, you know, though of course everybody's attacking me. How could you write Rafa off? You know, you didn't predict him to win. He was down two sets, and I said that this match is over. But so just give me your thoughts on, you know, when you first saw Rafael Nadal as a kid, and then just how he's been able to do what he's been able to do over the course of these last, you know, 20 years of him being on the tour.
You know, when I think of Rafa, I think of Borg. Mm. I think they're the two more similar mental guys that I've seen in my tennis career. I always thought Borg, not always, but I thought that Borg was maybe a little stronger mentally, but that I changed my mind on that, to be honest. So the first time I saw Rafa was when he was 14 years old. I spent a little time with Carlos Moya, spent a year with him after coming back from an injury, and I went to Mallorca, and I saw this kid, and I mean the level of intensity on every single ball he hit was unbelievable. And he was already, you know, people were talking about him already, and then he's such a competitor, and the thing I like the most about Rafa's is how simple he keeps everything. Mm. I mean, how the simplicity on what he does is really amazing to me. Understanding how complicated it is to compete at that level with the pressures that are there and all that. So if you look at Rafa. Rafa when he was young and you look at it today, how much better tennis player he is. I mean, he was a guy that I remember watching him play Andy Murray, I believe in 2006 2007, 2008 at the Australian Open, and were just bringing him in, and he looked so awkward and so bad. And I would say that at this point, Rafa is, if not the most complete, definitely at the top of the most complete players in the game. He's one guy that will not miss an easy volley. He's got great drafters on both sides. His backhand slice is may not be a textbook, but he makes it work pretty damn well. And basically, every time you see him, he actually does something a little bit better. Mm. Something that you haven't seen him that before, or if you've seen him do that before, he's actually doing it better. So he's so thirsty. And actually, I'll tell you something that nobody knows, Patty, but I'll tell you, I was so close to work with him. And when he got that beat up in Australia,
right?
I was that match on TV, and I taped it, and I watched it a few times, and I took some notes. Mm-hmm. And I know Rafa, and I know Tony well, and we're good friends, and I love him to death. So I have never once called a player in my life to offer advice or anything. So I called Tony, mm-hmm. and Tony answered the phone and he said, "Pepe, hey, listen, believe it or not, I was thinking of you. I was gonna call you as soon as we got home. We are in Singapore."
Right.
So I said, "Tony, this is what I saw." So I kind of went through a list of things that I saw, and he said, "Listen, Rafa is going to the Indian Wells in another month and a half. I'm not gonna go. I'm gonna talk to him when he gets there." So anyway, I make a very short. I got together with him. We talk about all those things. I was in the club with him for a few days with Francis. And then he ended up winning the tournament. Not because I was that good, because he was that good, obviously.
Right, but you helped, right.
And then the thought was that once I went back, I was going to meet with them at the French. Mm-hmm. And then we were going to establish something. But he went and won every single thing, like he does pretty much every year. All right. The Clicquot tournament. So I saw Tony. I said, "Tony, listen, Pepe, everything is going so well, you know, right now. Why don't we leave it like that?" And I said, "That's fine with me."
Yeah, because anyway, he took all your information and he used it, and then the rest is history. You know, I mean,
Well, that happens, you know, but that happened. But it made me so happy once again when I see him. He's becoming a 35. I mean, he's becoming a better player every time you see him play, which is pretty unbelievable.
Well, in my opinion, him using the backhand slice midway through the match with Medvedev in the final, actually, I thought helped turn the match around because he started.
Absolutely.
I remember he kind of looked at Carlos Moya, who's now his coach, of course, and has been with him for a couple of years. And as you said, you worked with Carlos for a while. Great guy. Yes. And he kind of looked at him, and Carlos kind of gave him a look with the eyes. You know, of course, you're not allowed to coach. You're not supposed to coach. Yeah. But it was like, okay, like, you know, we need plan B here. Plan B, or, you know, plan A is not working at the moment. And that's what's made Rafael Nadal so great. Okay, before I have one more guy I want to ask you about before we get into the USTA stuff, sure, is Juan Martín Del Potro, because he's the gentle giant. I just did a solo podcast on him, and you know, the disappointment that he's had, it seemingly is going to retire because of all his multiple injuries. And what did you think about that, and just about him as a person? I mean, I think he's universally loved as far as I can see as a player, because, you know, I call him the gentle giant because he's got this big, you know, powerful, unbelievable game, but just very soft spoken, and something about his personality as a competitor and as a player is just all class, isn't it?
Yes. You know, when I think about Juan Martin, I think about a great success and a sad story, both. I watched a clip of his match yesterday when he broke down when he was playing Del Bonis, and it's really sad. And I think one of the saddest things for an athlete is to have to retire because of injuries. And unfortunately, that happened to him. But I mean, he was legitimately the only guy that was challenging Rafa and Roger.
When they were at their absolute prime, their prime.
Yes, because he, you know, he was very good competitor. That's the first thing. So competitiveness was there, but he has so much leverage in his shots. Big serve, huge forehand, great backhand until he got hurt.
Right.
And he just was unlucky enough, you know, to actually come up with that risk injury. I don't know him personally as much as I will know Rafa or Roger.
Right.
But everything I've heard from him has been how kind he is. He always carries himself with class and show respect to everybody. So it's a tough situation. But it would have been interesting to actually see him play with these guys, you know, with Roger, Rafa, and Novak. At full speed, like he was, because he was the only guy that really scared them, to be honest.
Yeah,
he would take the racket out of your hand.
Right, and he also wasn't. He didn't seem to be intimidated by them, you know, psychologically when he went out on the court with them. All right, so we've already, and we knew this was going to happen, Jose. Okay, because we've already done the amount of time I usually do for one podcast, I want to get into this, you know, your experience with the USTA, because you and I, as I said, work together there. But here's the deal, okay? We've already gone 25 minutes, but we're going to go another whatever it takes to, because I want to hear your side of the story, and I know the tennis fans do. But here's the deal: I got to go teach a tennis lesson right now, okay? Great. So you're going to appreciate that. And I'm going to learn, I'm going to put in play the things I've learned from you. Cause actually in the last few years, since I left the USTA and then I went on to work with my brother at our academy here in New York, I've actually become more of a coach on the court, which is great. Cause I never really did that at the USTA, and I'm actually not that bad at it, Jose. And I give you a lot of credit for that. Cause you know, I'm decent. Maybe if I'd been more of a coach at the USTA, I might've done a better job.
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised. I never saw you as a politician, to be honest. So you kind of became one for a few years there. But I mean, you're a tennis guy. You're a tennis guy. You were a very good player. You love tennis. I mean, I'll hearing you on ESPN, you can tell if you were interested enough or loved the game enough, you wouldn't be as good as you are doing that. So anyway, I'm glad you have a lesson. I wish I had one, but I'm getting old and people don't want to work with you.
I doubt that very much. All right, so we're gonna take a little break here on Holding Court. Then when we come back, which is going to happen momentarily, although it's going to be in real time, it'll be, you know, in an hour or so. Let me do my lesson, Jose, and we'll get back and get your notes ready on your experience with the USTA, and we will hit that hard in part two of my podcast with the great Jose Higueras here on Holding Court.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.